This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Writer Donovan Hone's preoccupations with water mirror those that many of us who live in the Great Lakes carry around. He thinks about coastlines as messy places where different kinds of lives collide with each other. He thinks about fresh water, the most essential substance on Earth, and how far out of reach it is for so many of us. Hone, who teaches creative writing at Wayne State University, has written and edited for a slew of A-list publications like the New York Times, Harper's, and GQ. And he has a way of drilling down on details in ways that open up much broader ideas. He's just published a collection of essays called The Inner Coast, and he joins us from his home in Washtenaw County. Donovan Hone, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you, April.
You lead off the book with a long essay about a relative of yours, Tom, who collects tools. And you early on cop to the suspicion that tool collectors may be motivated by slightly odd feelings and that they're definitely an unusual bunch. But you grow fascinated through the essay by Tom's fascination with tools. And you note some of the fetishized aspects of tool history, the proliferation of tools and what it says about skilled labor in America during the first few hundred years. And there was this time when America's top tool was the wood plane, when woodcraft was sort of the dominant hand industry. And then you bring us along through the rise of the wrench and industrialization and mechanization. Could you read for us from a point in this, maybe set up the reading as well?
Yeah, so this is a passage that comes in response to a book by Eric Sloan, who was at the time a kind of a classic historian of antique woodworking tools. Here's the passage. Time, it seems, is an ironist. That spring, factory workers were being laid off in record numbers. Michigan alone had lost 171,000 manufacturing jobs in the previous 4 years, and the riveters and machine operators Eric Sloan derided seemed like skilled artisans compared with the technicians and sales associates replacing them. The era of the wrench, like the era of the plane before it, is ending. Predictably, the ranks of wrench collectors recently have begun to swell. Although still worth far less than a desirable plane, a rare and pristine John Deere tractor wrench can now fetch hundreds of dollars at auction. Partly, this reflects the enthusiasm in rural America for the antique tractors with which such wrenches were originally sold. But the popularity of other wrench varieties, pipe wrenches, automobile wrenches, buggy wrenches, battery cable pulling wrenches, is also growing. The decline of American manufacturing has given rise to pastoralism's post-industrial analog, a romance of rust.
That's Donovan Hone reading from an essay in The Inner Coast, his book just published. Donovan, what does that romance of rust tell you about who we are and where we are right now?
I think that part of what was fascinating to me when I was traveling with my uncle Tom, who was a botanist, he was collecting these tools from estate auctions, from condemned factories, and he would taxonomize them, almost treat them like they were zoological specimens, which is a very different way of looking at these artifacts of America's material history than how many collectors look at them. For many collectors, I think that the act of collecting, there's a yearning for kind of lost knowledge and lost time, an attempt to preserve it in the form of the objects. And they were amazingly beautiful, actually, many of these tools. And my uncle never wanted to restore them. He never wanted to touch them up with paint. He wanted to keep them in their actual state. So you could sometimes see places where a laborer's sweaty palm had left a mark in the oxidation of the metal. So I think that for me, that there's a way in which these tools came to kind of make visible to us something that's hard to see otherwise, which is the pace of technological change over the last century. That's, I think, what drew me into it. And how do we think about that change in ways that isn't nostalgic, that's clear-eyed, but also, how do we reckon with the genuine loss, I think, of all that labor and all that knowledge that those tools held?
Your writing style has a fantastic kind of elastic quality to it. You're giving us these scenes from bouncing around to estate sales and other places with Tom, but also sort of taking us down the wormhole into Sloan's historical research into this, warts and all. you don't really get caught up in an over linear telling of your story. And you're great about just jetting what you're supposed to be talking about in favor of what you find really interesting. Has that been a hard thing to learn how to pull off as a writer?
When I was a graduate student in poetry, of all things, there was the poet Frank Bedard, actually, whom I quote in this particular essay, had this really nice, helpful thing, which he said that after you've learned how other minds make meaning, you have to learn how your mind makes meaning. And I have found that for me, that I always need to be doing both. For me, the essays I love as a reader, but also that I've tried to learn to write, will take us on journeys, tell stories, help us meet people who are fun to read about. But there's always a kind of an attempt to make sense of something that's accompanying that journey, that narrative. And that's just kind of how my brain works, I think.
This is a collection of essays that appeared in a lot of different publications over really many years. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of pulling them together and anything you noticed?
Well, at Wayne State University, where I teach writing now, I teach a course on the essay collection as theme and variation. So I almost think of it as if we're thinking about like a piece of music, a Bach fugue or whatever, where you kind of introduce a theme and then you try to complicate it and complicate it and complicate it. And I think there's a way in which I'm trying to do that, at least in this essay collection. One thing that's unusual for me, though, is I wrote them over many years. And I think the more one writes, the more one realizes that we can't quite ever escape our own preoccupations. You almost don't have to try. The themes or ideas or geographies that you keep returning to, kind of, they're a little bit mysterious in their origins, but they're there. So they emerged over the course of these. The first earliest essay in the book I wrote probably in the year 2000. So it's almost 20 years of these.
As you're talking about the essential qualities of water, you also point out the ways in which humanity or Western civilization has sort of stopped thinking about that. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, this is fascinating. There's a paradox to me, which is at a time when we have more information, more ways of understanding the world than we'll ever be able to explore in a lifetime. I mean, we could go onto Google Earth and look at every river and body of water on the planet now and from the safety of our desk. That coincides with a kind of distance or alienation from an actual kind of firsthand, intimate knowledge of I think, much of the natural world. So we can watch a BBC's Blue Planet and see things that are under the waves, but to actually experience it or study a river the way people did when they had to navigate them, that kind of knowledge, I think, has become increasingly abstract. It's even in our landscapes, I feel like, except for some picturesque waterfronts, that much of the water, many of the waterways of the interior have kind of receded from view. So there were, in a number of these essays, I'm trying to bring back the view from the water.
You've done some writing about the Flint water crisis.
Yeah.
And in this collection, we find your essay, The Zealot, which is about Mark Edwards, the Virginia Tech professor who became one of the leading critics of Flint in the water crisis. How did you meet him?
Well, so when I started talking to my editors at the Times Magazine about writing about him and the water crisis, frankly, Michigan Radio had done such wonderful reporting. The story was, this was early 2016 when finally the news was really getting out into the world. But Edwards was an interesting figure to me. What interested me most about his work was that in my experience, having written about lots of different scientists, especially in my first book, that there's a real tension often in the sciences between kind of pure science there as a detached observer doing research and any kind of advocacy or activism. So that's the main reason I was curious about him, because he was somebody who was very vocal in his advocacy. Those were kind of, that tension was what I kind of wanted to think through and explore in that piece.
You trace a bit of his journey from, in his words, sort of a regular college professor to something of a lightning rod, calling out problems in Flint and, as you say, taking more of an advocacy stance. But what a lot of people may not have known about him, at least outside of Flint, is that Edwards is also a conservative Republican who's much more concerned about misconduct in public institutions than in private ones. What did you learn about how he is seen within the field as you were working on this?
Well, in some ways that made him even more interesting, because it certainly, I think, went against my assumptions going in that he has this kind of libertarian streak in his politics. And, you know, I wanted to spend time with him in order to understand how to reconcile both. I mean, I think he's got a very sincere concern about environmental justice, and he'll say that, you know, he got into his field because of concern about what had happened to the Great Lakes when he was growing up, and he'd witnessed Lake Erie get kind of saved by the Clean Water Act. And so those things can be reconciled. But I think the other thing that was fascinating to me was watching how much of a deft storyteller he was. And I felt that in some ways that the storytelling could maybe be complicated. When I visited him, a book on his floor in the place where he lives in Virginia, it was a book kind of as a horrible title. It was called Houston, We Need a Narrative. And it was by a scientist turned screenwriter, kind of telling people how to use the methods of Hollywood storytelling to help communicate science to the public. And I think that in some ways, the more I spent time with him, I think that I felt that the storytelling tended to be a little bit scripted in that kind of classic villains and victims kind of way.
Right.
So that's what I was trying to make sense of.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Donovan Hoehn. His new book is a collection of essays from the past decade or so. It's called The Inner Coast. You write at some length in one of the essays in the book, Falling, about your childhood, growing up outside of San Francisco on Mount Davidson. Could you tell us a little bit about your parents?
Yeah, I could. Well, you know, my father grew up in a town called Philo, Illinois, which almost sounds like a ridiculously idyllic name for a small town on the plains of Illinois. But really, in his side of the family, there was a devotion to the public university. My grandmother was the first in her family to go to college, and it was on a scholarship to the University of Illinois. And he decided in the 60s to do a medical career and ended up in academic medicine, which carried him to California eventually for a residency in San Francisco. My mother's family was very itinerant. She was an Air Force brat. My grandfather was a colonel. But after his military career, he too ended up in central Illinois, which is where she met my father. And she, even before he went out to California, had a real, in her youth, a real kind of wanderlust and energy that I think made her restless. And she actually bicycled across the western United States from Milwaukee to Northern California.
At a time when that was not done, especially by single women.
No, yeah, it was 1963 that she did it. She was a young 20-something. She had a buddy for the first part of it, but from the Rocky Mountains to the coast, she was solo. No, it was gutsy and impressive. And that's how she ended up out on the coast of California. She'd had a dream that she was going to hop a steamship across the Pacific to reunite with a boy she'd met at a Red Cross training camp in Japan. It was a Korean boy she'd met, and she had been dreaming of reuniting with him, and that journey was interrupted, and I am the result of the interruption.
Your parents had a very difficult marriage.
They did.
And your mother actually ran away for a while when you and your brother were small kids. There are some really heartbreaking passages in this essay about her time away. Do you mind reading a little bit?
No, I don't. I'll just say she was, you know, this was part of the project for me in this essay was trying to understand her departures. And the easy way to understand them might be to say that she was clinically depressive, which I believe she was. But for her, it was much more than that. She had experienced a kind of crisis of faith after a very religious upbringing. And I wanted to write as empathetically about her experience and my own, which was difficult. So here's a passage. The year before we moved to the mountain, when I was almost 3 and my brother was 5, our mother had run away. For 9 months, or was it 8 or 6, testimonies conflict as they always do, memories fail as they always do. The record, as always, is unclear. She'd lived by herself in a boarding hotel near the train yards of South San Francisco. The first night she was gone, I woke up terrified that something horrible had befallen us. Above me, The mattress of my brother's bunk had begun to shed its gauzy underside, which hung down in strings that I liked to pluck at, making them longer. Atop the dresser, our fish tank gurgled and glowed. A year later, on the morning we moved to Mount Davidson, I would try to carry it, still full of water, out to the truck and succeed only in dunking the lid far enough for the bulb inside to electrify the tank's lonely resident, a zebrafish, which on the night my mother left drifted obliviously through plastic kelp, a rebuke to the hysteria that had awakened me. Uncharacteristically brave in the darkness, I conducted a thorough investigation of the premises. In the bedroom where my mother usually could be found, my giant father, snoring and alone, sprawled diagonally atop the tangled sheets as if dropped there from a great height. I looked in closets, under furniture, even inside the dishwasher, from which I distinctly remember steam rose.
What do you tell your students about taking on uncomfortable subjects?
Oh, lots of things. And it kind of depends on the subject, and it kind of depends on their relationship to the subject. If we're thinking about writing about painfully personal material, I think it's not uncommon that sometimes as writers we need a certain amount of distance. Really, I think this was able to write this essay, began working on it, I think, when I was around 30, and it took a while. So there was distance from it. I think that when one is writing, in some ways I feel very much that this essay, more than any others in the book, is mine to tell. Certainly it contains many of my earliest memories and experiences. But we never are just telling our own stories. That's, I think, one of the challenges. Our stories are always entangled with the world around us, whether it's with the lives of family members or neighbors or a polity. And so it takes a great deal of care in how one handles the stories, one's own stories, but also those of others. I think when writing about family members or loved ones, for me, there are two great dangers. One is that we might sentimentalize loved ones. And I do think that that can be a kind of a form of dehumanizing them, simplifying them. And then, of course, I think sometimes in memoirs, there's a risk of we don't want to vilify. You'll lose the trust of the readers if it feels like we're settling some sort of score. So it takes it's a strange combination of great emotional empathy, but also a certain amount of detachment from one's own emotions, I think, to do it with the needed delicacy.
That's pretty Herculean, considering the subject matter that you're working with here. Donovan Hone's latest collection of essays is The Inner Coast, and it's available right now from Norton Books. It's the kind of read that really works if you're looking for something to disappear into right now. Donovan, thanks very much for talking with us.
April, thank you so much for having me.